Odessa area. It's 89 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
It's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Jobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on Psych and Sound Broadcasting. Our first article will be from our August issue. It's the state. This is news and politics. It's a dispatch from Katie Nojimbadam, and it's entitled, Paris is Yearning. Can the Black Lives Matter movement heal a town riven by a century and a half of racial strife? Carolyn Williams, a 66-year-old great-grandmother who has lived in Paris for over 40 years, was used to lonely protests. For years, she had attended demonstrations against police brutality and racial discrimination in a northeast Texas town featuring just a handful of other people. Sometimes she was the only one. In late May, when she decided to organize a protest in response to the killing of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police officers, she wasn't sure if anyone else would join her. Nonetheless, she posted her plans on Facebook, crafted a sign demanding justice for George Floyd, and made her way to the downtown plaza, determined to speak out even if she was the only one who showed up. When she reached the plaza, she found that two other women, one black, one white, neither of whom she had met before, were already there, holding their own homemade signs. Throughout the evening, others trickled into the square, and by the end of the night, about 20 protesters had gathered. To Williams' surprise, roughly half were white. To see a man get killed with a cop on his neck, it was devastating, she said. It wasn't nothing that you could stay at home and be quiet about. Black Lives Matter, a global movement that first emerged in 2013, was far from quiet. In the wake of Floyd's killing, as many as 26 million Americans took part in demonstrations across the country. But something was different in this chapter of the movement, and it wasn't just that demonstrators wore masks to protect one another from the coronavirus. The protests weren't limited to Texas's big liberal-leaning cities. They also popped up in even the smallest, most conservative corners of the state, including some with violently racist pasts. The day after Williams' protest, more than 70 gathered in Longview, the site of one of the notorious race riots of the Red Summer of 1919 that swept dozens of American cities. On June 2nd, a large group marched in Stephenville, where, in 1922, black bodies had been exhumed and relocated to a black-only cemetery. And on June 6th, in Vidor, an East Texas town that's more than 90% white and is known for having open Ku Klux Klan activity as recently as the 90s, at least 150 attended a BLM demonstration. That May protest in Paris wasn't a one-off. Williams and other activists have since organized several more demonstrations, including one on June 4th that attracted about 100 marchers along the perimeter of the plaza. For black activists in Paris, a city of 25,000 that was largely bypassed by the civil rights movement of the 60s, the protests were both welcome and overdue. A march in Paris, Texas, is an indicator of the possibility of change more so than a march in New York or Chicago, said Dwight D. Watson, the author of Race and the Houston Police Department, and a retired professor of African-American history at Texas State University. Give me Paris, Texas, and I'll give you a changed world, because if it'll change there, it'll change everywhere. Organizers in Paris, the county seat of Lamar County, are attempting to overcome an infamous and gruesome past. A few years after the Civil War ended, the federal government sent Colonel DeWitt C. Brown, a representative of the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, to Paris to assist recently emancipated people. By the time Brown arrived, white gangs and the newly established outpost of the Klan had launched a campaign of terror against black residents and their Republican supporters. Brown, who survived several attempts on his life before his superiors instructed him to close his office in 1868, reported to the Bureau that the cup of bitterness was overflowing. White residents were resentful over the defeat of the Confederacy and the new social status of emancipated black people. Locals warned him that as soon as he left town or was killed, the region would be perfumed with dead. As the black population in Paris gradually increased and a black middle class emerged, racial tensions grew. Between 1890 and 1920, white mobs lynched at least 9 black men in Paris, one of the worst sites of racial terror in Texas during a period of extraordinary violence. The killing of 17-year-old Henry Smith in 1893 made national headlines and is credited with inspiring decades of spectacle lynchings. After the handyman was accused without evidence of killing the 3-year-old daughter of a former cop, Smith fled for his life. He was eventually captured, and instead of being tried in a court of law, he was tortured for 2 hours by a mob of white Parisians, who then burned him alive in front of a crowd of 10,000, many of whom scrambled to grab his body parts for souvenirs. Then in 1920, brothers Herman and Irving Arthur decided to leave the cruel conditions of the tenant farm they labored on. When the white farm owner, John Hodges, confronted them on their way out of town, a violent altercation ensued that ended with Hodges and his son shot dead. Authorities eventually caught the brothers in Oklahoma before returning them to Paris. A white mob stormed the jail and dragged them to the fairgrounds, where the two men were burned at the stake in front of 3,000 spectators. Fearing for their safety, thousands of black residents fled Lamar County over the next decade. In recent years, civic leaders have tried to promote the image of a prosperous, racially diverse town that's moved beyond its violent past, but a string of recent incidents has contradicted that message. In 2006, Lamar County Judge Chuck Superville sentenced Shaconda Cotton, a 14-year-old black student at Paris High School, to as much as 7 years in prison after she was accused of shoving a hall monitor. Outraged Parisians compared her punishment with that of a white girl, also 14, who had been sentenced to probation by Superville for setting fire to her family's home. In 2008, two white men were charged with murdering Brandon McClellan by running him over and then dragging his body for 40 feet. The men were released after a prosecutor dropped the charges, citing a lack of evidence, despite the blood and tissue found on the underside of the truck. In 2010, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission found that black employees at the Turner Industries pipe factory in Paris were subjected to unwelcome racial slurs, comments and intimidation, racial graffiti, nooses in the workplace, and other symbols of discrimination. Chris Dux, a retired hospital CEO and the chairman of the Lamar County Republican Party, blames the town's racial tensions on a handful of local racial justice advocates. "The Black Lives Matter movement is setting race relations back 50 years or more," said Dux. "They want to blame people today for things that happened 150 years ago. He argued that the public school system provides black children excellent educational opportunities and that the numerous interracial couples he's seen in Paris prove that allegations of widespread racism in town have been exaggerated. Today, Paris has no statues, monuments, or plaques that acknowledge its racial conflicts. But a bronze statue of a Confederate soldier watches over the grounds of Lamar County Courthouse. Erected in 1903 by the United Daughters of the Confederacy as part of their crusade to commemorate the lost cause, the monument also features the busts of 4 Confederate leaders, including Robert E. Lee. Like so many struggles for racial justice, the fight in Paris is centered in part on symbols. Brenda Cherry, a longtime civil rights leader, tried in 2017 to have the statue relocated from the courthouse to the former home of Confederate Major General Sam Bell Maxey, a state historic site. Cherry, who is now 62, rallied a small group of Parisians to lobby the Lamar County Commissioner's Court to petition the state for permission to make the move. On the day of the vote in June 2017, 24 monument defenders, many of them carrying Confederate flags, filled the courthouse to hear Superville announce the decision of the all-white court. On a 2-2 vote, one commissioner was absent. The petition request was rejected. The monument would stay. Cherry says she was one of just 2 attendees. The other was a white man who spoke that day in favor of the statue's relocation and recalls at least one monument defender throwing around the N-word in her presence in the meeting room. Other Parisians attacked her with racist vitriol on social media. It was clear, without more white support, the monument wouldn't be going anywhere. By the time Parisians took to the streets this May and June, longtime friends Taisley Scroggin, a 27-year-old health insurance agent, and 32-year-old Latrell Lacey, a Sleek Tech had been discussing race and class inequality for years. Even though Scroggin and Lacey are white, they were nervous about speaking out. In a town like this, it's kind of a scary concept to stick your neck out, said Scroggin, a preacher's kid who grew up in the Dallas area but moved to Detroit, just outside Paris, when she was in high school. But I think, finally, we're feeling a little emboldened. That revolution is happening right now in front of us. There's not time to decide anymore. You either get with it or you get gone. They attended the protests organized by Williams and Cherry, but wanted to do more. So on June 10th, they sent a letter to the commissioner's court requesting the relocation of the Confederate statue. The courthouse, a symbol of justice, should not specifically be highlighting the values of the Confederacy, they wrote. The next day, Scroggin and Lacey posted the letter on change.org, and within a couple weeks, the petition had almost 2,000 signatures, most of whom are Paris residents, the women say. Soon after, two counterpetitions appeared on the same site. One of them warned that you cannot change history by removing statues. Those petitions each have about 800 signatures. A member of Paris's Historic Preservation Commission, Tux, thinks the statue should stay put, but he allows that the addition of a sign could help educate passersby about the Confederacy. Removing the statue doesn't remove what happened 150 years ago, he said. But Scroggin and Lacey counter that they are confronting their heritage with eyes wide open, not denying history. We felt that it was extremely important that white women put it up, so white women should take it down, Scroggin said of the statue. Cherry, who grew up in nearby Blossom, but had to be bused to Paris during grade school because there wasn't a black school in her town, welcomes the young pair's contributions. I'll probably do civil rights work and social justice work until the day I die, and if white people are willing to help, I'm more than glad to have that help, she said. Cherry, who is Paris's most well-known activist, has developed a reputation for stirring up trouble and has for years been the target of online abuse and stalking. You have to be willing to lose something if you do what I do. I'm willing to lose it all, she said. Both Scroggin and Lacey say they understand the risks of speaking out. Scroggin worries about her job, and Lacey has a son and two stepchildren, has ordered security cameras for her home. During one BLM protest in Paris, opponents parked nearby and poked guns out of the windows of their vehicles. But the white women note that their black neighbors face much worse every day. The two friends have launched an activist group they're calling the Paris Collective. It currently has seven members, six of whom are white. Scroggin and Lacey plan to use their social media platforms to educate other Parisians on a variety of injustices, from the history of racial inequalities in the area to the mistreatment of migrant children in detention centers elsewhere. People are starting to see how systemic racism has affected their own community and people that they know and love, and they're starting to address their own internal racism, said Lacey. Next, the group hopes to convince city leaders to invest in the predominantly black side of town by encouraging business development and fixing streets in need of repair. Watson was surprised by the size of the protests in Paris, but is skeptical about the staying power of a movement driven in part by the revolutionary zeal of newly inspired activists, and wonders if the pain of change could stymie actual change. But things in Paris are already changing. On July 5th, one day before the 100th anniversary of the lynching of the Arthur brothers, descendants of the Arthurs and the family of the white farmer, John Hodges, gathered at the Red River Valley Veterans Memorial for a remembrance ceremony organized by a coalition of local pastors and by Melinda Waters, the great-great-granddaughter of Hodges. During the ceremony, Waters read a letter of apology to the Arthurs' descendants. I'm writing to you, 100 years belated, to say that I lament the monstrous lynching and murder of Herman and Irving Arthur, she said. I'm sorry for the ways that the white community, my family, and myself have been complicit in both my biases against black people and in accordance with a system that continues to disproportionately allow violence upon their bodies. Coalition also announced that it is working to establish a community memorial in Paris to honor the Arthur brothers. Another recent incident revealed both Paris's persistent racial animus and the ability of the Black Lives Matter movement to affect change. In late June, video circulated on social media of a violent encounter between a 16-year-old black teen and a white man. The teen and his brother were walking by a gas station where the man, who has not been publicly identified by police, was pumping gas into his truck, which was marked with a Bechert Construction decal. It was an exchange of words, which, with some activists claiming the man used a racial slur, what happened next is captured partially on video. The two got into a brawl in which the man landed several blows before the teen ended the fight by slamming the man to the ground, knocking him unconscious. Robert Jameson, a 58-year-old white man whom Paris police describe as a bystander, then entered the fray. According to the police, Jameson produced a handgun, told the 16-year-old to drop the pocket knife he was holding, and ordered the brothers onto the ground at gunpoint before driving off. Police arrived shortly thereafter, but didn't make any arrests, to the anger of the boys' family members and friends, who soon arrived at the gas station with video recorded and video recorded the aftermath. After footage of the altercation circulated on social media, dozens of Parisians, including Williams, Cherry, Scroggin, and Lacey, assembled in front of the Paris Police Department to demand the arrest of Jameson and the man who fought the teen. The demonstrators then marched on a gas station, spreading it out across the road and blocking traffic, a tactic often used by protesters in big cities but virtually unheard of in Paris. Standing with linked arms, the protesters chanted, "No justice, no peace." Several cars bullied their way through the crowd, but the protesters quickly reassembled. A few days later, the police arrested Jameson on charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and unlicensed possession of a firearm by a felon. Jameson, who could not be reached for comment, was released on $20,000 bail. Later that week, the protesters notched another victory. The city council announced that it would seek to end a contract with Bechard Construction, the company that employed the man who threw the punches. On July 4, a couple hundred Parisians gathered in a park for the Peace and Power rally, the largest yet of the recent BLM events. Between the food stands and dance music, there was an air of jubilee, but organizers also wanted to capitalize on the anger over the fight at the gas station. In an open forum, attendees, who dressed mostly in black, brainstormed ways to pressure local officials to make arrests, and Scroggin worked a booth where people could register to vote and sign the statue removal petition. Despite the new energy, Cherry worries that no jury in Paris will find Jameson guilty, and she doesn't trust authorities to fairly investigate the other man. However, she's also confident that nothing would have happened if she and others hadn't put forth a simple but radical proposition. Black lives matter, even in Paris, Texas. The author of this piece, Katie Nojimbadem, is a writer from El Paso whose work has recently appeared in Smithsonian, Airmail, Texas Monthly, and on NewYorker.com. We turn now to another story in this August issue. If the state section, this is Being Texan, it's History by Wes Ferguson. Entitled this month, The Edge Dwellers. Decades ago, an unruly clan of people called the Cedar Choppers lived in the hill country and scared the wits out of Austinites. Today, expensive homes dot the hills of Austin's western fringe. There was a time, not so long ago, when respectable townspeople avoided the highlands just outside the city. There, along the Balcones Escarpment, geological fault zone marking the eastern edge of the Edwards Plateau, a reclusive folk known as Cedar Choppers lived hard and free on the rugged terrain, and polite company kept its distance. Austin native Ken Roberts was 10 or 11 the first time he encountered the children of Cedar Choppers at the low water crossing of the Colorado River below the Lake Austin Dam sometime in the mid-50s. "I remember how different from us they looked," he writes in his 2018 book, The Cedar Choppers, Life on the Edge of Nothing, from Texas A&M University Press. "They were barefoot, their pants were too short, their shirts ragged. These were not kids you would see in Austin. The boys set Roberts on edge, and when his friend Dudley taunted them, one of them pulled out a club. Roberts and Dudley ran. Who are these people?" he wondered. Roberts, a retired economics professor at Southwestern University in Georgetown, answers his own question in The Cedar Choppers. Based largely on interviews and newspaper archives, the book is in its fifth printing, an impressive run for an academic title. Its popularity attests, perhaps, to modern Central Texans' fascination with a group of people they replaced, a marginalized yet proudly independent band of Southern whites whose lineage stretches back to a Scotch-Irish warrior culture in the British Isles. The mountain clans that would come to be known as the Cedar Choppers or Cedar Whackers first settled in Appalachia in the 18th century. moving west through the Ozarks before finding their way to central Texas shortly after the Civil War. An earlier wave of German and Anglo settlers had already established farms throughout the Hill Country, but their intensive tilling and overgrazing practices quickly depleted the region's thin topsoil, allowing ash juniper, a shrubby tree known colloquially as mountain cedar, to spread out of the region's steep canyons and across disturbed rocky slopes where native grasses once grew. By the turn of the 20th century, most of the wealthy farmers had moved on to greener pastures. The mountain folk didn't have much to begin with, and they were well suited for the woodlands, so they hunkered down. For generations, they eked out a meager existence, hunting, fishing, stocking semi-feral pigs and cattle, distilling moonshine, and cutting cedar, which they used to build zigzagging worm fences, rustic barns, or burned to sell as charcoal. As the nature writer John Graves explains in his 1973 essay collection, Hard Scrabble, Observations on a Patch of Land, the cedar people asked less of the land and of life than those who had come before. The land had much less to give. The mountain folk represented but a sliver of the Scots-Irish people who settled in Texas, of course. Isolation allowed them to keep their ways, Roberts says. As the already clannish cedar choppers further withdrew from society, they became ever more insular. Folklorist Alan Lomax encountered cedar chopper families in the 30s and recorded them singing traditional English ballads like The Romish Lady and Seven Long Years. They had their own manner of speaking, distinct from their fellow Texans, and lived by a code of freedom and personal honor. There was a lot of murder and mayhem going on, Robert said, but they wouldn't steal. That culture, defined by a warrior ethic, stubborn pride, and a distrust of legal institutions, and a lilting dialect, is an ancient one that developed on lands bordering the Irish Sea, according to the 1989 book Albion's Seed, Four British Folkways in America, which traces the influence of successive waves of immigration from the British Isles on regional cultures in the United States. Distinctive words like bumfuzzled and scoot, and the use of an emphatic double negative, I never sold none, for example, as well as the figurative use of earthy terms for bodily functions, all arose in the borderlands of Northern Ireland, the lowlands of Scotland, and Northern Britain. A backcountry granny would kindly say to a little child, "Ain't you a cute little shit?" Albion's Seed author David Hackett Fisher writes. More than a quarter million Scots-Irish people immigrated to America through much of the 1700s. Many were desperately poor, Fisher notes. In the mid-20th century, however, the cedar choppers' fortunes took a fateful turn. Ranches had begun to replace farms in agrarian Texas, and cattle required fences to keep them from roaming free. Cedar was in high demand for fence posts, and the hill people, newly incentivized, began cutting cedar at a prodigious rate and hauling it on flatbed trucks across Texas, the Great Plains, and the West, where it commanded top dollar. By the 40s, Roberts writes, the once impoverished people were flush with cash, and the name cedar choppers came into use. They were making more money than any working man in Austin. That's just astounding to me, Roberts said. They could make $25 a day when it might take a typical working man a week to make that much money. They had no boss. A little sidebar here. If you can't chop them, burn them. In the early 20th century, cedar choppers were more widely known as charcoal makers. They burned so much cedar on the banks of the Guadalupe River that an entire section of the river from Sisterdale to New Braunfels was nicknamed Charcoal City. And now we're back to the text. Most cedar choppers didn't use their riches to improve their long-term fortunes, however. Roberts says many of them preferred to live for the moment, eating high on the hog and drinking heavily. They didn't care about possessions, he says, and they lived in housing fit for animals. Old-timers in the hill country still tell stories about the cedar choppers, many involving violence and booze, though Roberts makes clear in his book that the rowdiest men were a minority. Most of the choppers were content to lead quiet lives. One descendant of the cedar choppers interviewed by Roberts recalled wild Saturday nights in Junction, where he saw three fights happening at once with his father in the middle of the melee. "Yeah, my daddy. Hell, he'd get on a mule and ride 10 miles to get in a fist fight," the man said. Cedar choppers also play a starring role in one of Texas Monthly's most outrageous stories, a 1975 Gary Cartwright narrative about dogfights, which opens with a cedar chopper stabbing a convenience store clerk after an argument over a 5-cent increase in the price of a 6-pack of beer. Though people throughout Central Texas were scared of the cedar choppers, nowhere did their 19th century ways collide more forcefully with proper society than in Austin, where life revolved around the state capitol and the University of Texas. When they arrived in the 40s and 50s with cedar posts in tow and thirsty for rowdy nights in bars on 6th Street, they shocked middle-class residents, according to Roberts. The men were filthy from tree sap, which stuck to their skin and mingled with sweat and dust from cedar bark. They lived like hell and played like hell, Roberts recalls. They weren't ashamed of it. And if you looked down on them, he adds, they'd kick your ass. Austin's elite, despite their fears, or perhaps because of them, responded to the presence of cedar choppers with ridicule. One country club hosted a Hill Country cedar chopper-themed dance replete with hillbilly costumes and fake beards. Cedar choppers also entered the region's folklore as boogeymen, featured in the kind of scary stories told around a crackling campfire. The term cedar chopper became a catch-all pejorative for the region's hillbillies, not unlike an Okie in California and cracker in Georgia. Today, the equivalent term would be white trash or redneck. Of course, the cedar chopper's heyday couldn't last. By the middle of the 20th century, after chainsaws replaced double-bladed axes, nearly anyone was able to fell cedar with relative ease. Even more ruinous was the arrival around the same time of steel T-posts, metal fence posts imported from Japan that quickly replaced cedar posts. Technology put nearly all the cedar choppers out of business, says Roberts, who spent his academic career researching the effects of economic change on marginalized rural people in Mexico and China before turning his attention to the marginalized folks closer to home. By 1960, Roberts writes, most of the choppers had left the hills, moving reluctantly into town and working as truckers or masons or at any job where they could maintain some semblance of independence. Today, only a few professional cedar choppers live alongside the vacationers, retirees, and ranchette owners who predominate in the hills west of the Balcones Escarpment. This country's growing over way too quick out here, cedar chopper Nolan Allen lamented on a recent morning outside his home near the foot of the Devil's Backbone Ridge, south of Wimberley, where the exurban sprawl envelops a patch of land his family has owned for more than a century. Nolan is no bogeyman. An affable 28-year-old with a burly physique and a handshake as rough as tree bark, he bought his first chainsaw, an Echo CS3000, when he was 11 years old to cut posts alongside his father, Stanley. It's something we love to do, Nolan said. Get out in the brush and you can't hear your phone ring and you're by yourself. It's more or less therapy, I guess you'd say. Nice and quiet except for that chainsaw, but you tune that out after a minute. There's still some demands for cedar posts, and the Allens work hard to meet it. I can cut one of them in 4 or 5 minutes, Nolan said. He also cuts smaller sections called stays, which are used as fence pickets. A stay is 5 feet long, which Nolan measures by standing it upright and cutting it off where it reaches his shirt pocket. His dad cuts each stay at a height between his first and second shirt button. Along with Nolan's younger brother, Clayton, the Allens worked out deals with neighboring landowners who allow them to harvest the trees free of charge. Generally, what we do is we'll cut the cedar, and then we'll clean the brush and trim the trees and make everything look pretty, Nolan said. If they had to pay to harvest posts and stays, he says they wouldn't be able to turn a profit. Cedar posts fell even further out of favor about a decade ago when prices for steel posts plummeted. These days, he said, the only people who prefer cedar fences are set in their ways, live in coastal areas where steel erodes quickly, or simply like the hill country aesthetic. Nolan's dad, Stanley, a friendly fellow in a threadbare work shirt, paint-spattered jeans, tells meandering stories in a sing-songy twang that could pass for Appalachian mountain talk. He was a teenager in the early 70s, he said, when he bought a chainsaw at a garage sale for his own father, who was about 60 years old and had always used a double-bit axe. I was tired of watching him chopping all damn day, Stanley recalled. I drove in there, and Daddy's out there sharpening that old axe. I got out the saw, and he said, what the hell is that? It's your present, Stanley told him. I don't want that damn thing, came the reply. Well, you got it anyway, Stanley said. The old man was stubborn. Took him a long time to come around to the chainsaw. He was a tough old fart, is all I could say, Stanley recalled. Take a natural break right here and remind you you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on site and sound broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Broadcasting since 1967. Back to our text. Like their warrior clan forebears, the Allens tell plenty of stories about not backing down from confrontations that erupt when they're chopping cedar, particularly when property lines are in dispute. One woman sicked her dog on the brothers. The dog apparently didn't know what sick 'em meant. It ran around but didn't attack. Another time, a man confronted them with a baseball bat. Clayton fired up that brand new chainsaw and said, "You done brought a bat to a chainsaw fight, mister," Nolan said, guffawing. Nolan shrugged off the dangers inherent to working with gas-powered, razor-sharp saws. "We've had a few close calls, but nothing bad," he said, proceeding to describe a friend who nearly cut his own hand off. Another time, about a decade ago, Nolan tripped on a piece of barbed wire. "When I tried to throw the saw out from underneath me, it caught my knee and chewed it up," he said. "I could actually see my kneecap in there. I rubbed Purell in it, tied a Band-Aid around it, and kept going. A friend told him he should seek immediate medical treatment, but Nolan didn't think it could be stitched up, and he didn't want to miss work. It was pretty gnarly looking," he said of the scar, "but it's about gone now." Nolan has heard the scary stories about cedar choppers that have been circulating in the hill country for generations. He thinks the legends grew because he and his brethren had such imposing physiques. "You spend all day carrying a chainsaw or carrying posts, and everybody's built," he said. "Like me, I'm kind of round, but I can pick up 400 pounds and walk off with it, all from cutting cedar and firewood." The Allens admit they're among a dying breed. "We're narrowed down here, but we make the best of it," Stanley said. For Ken Roberts, though, the cedar chopper's presence is as vivid now as it was when he first encountered them more than six decades ago. "It's like they were from another country, another language, another culture," he says. "And only people who live along the Balcones Fault know who the hell they were. Nobody else does." That finishes up our August edition, which brings us to our new September magazine. And we're real lucky this time. It comes with a special edition, additional magazine. This is a Texas Monthly Special Edition's Willie Nelson, Now More Than Ever. It's got a great cover picture of a profile of Willie with his eyes closed and his long hair, very much gray, and a gray mustache and beard. But he's looking very good in this one. Huh? Can't see all the wrinkles and age on a fella. That's good. We're going to open with the September issue like we always do. This is Best of the Web. Meanwhile, over on the internet, and we may get to some of their internet stories too, like we have been recently. Staycation tips, country stars, resilient bar owners, and amateur sleuths can be found at TexasMonthly.com. One section on there, an online sleuth identified the shooter after an Austin police officer shot onlooker Brad Levy Ayala with a beanbag round, inflicting brain damage during a late May protest. The police department refused to release the officer's name. So Brendan Walsh, a finance expert with no formal investigative background, began painstakingly examining the video evidence to identify the shooter. As Peter Holly reports, he succeeded. Texas's oldest lesbian bar faces its latest challenge. Sue Ellen's in Dallas is thought to be one of about 10 lesbian bars left in the United States. As Zoe Hamill and Trey Strange write, the coronavirus pandemic is far from the first crisis the bar has dealt with in its 31 years. The true story of the legendary Sam's Barbecue. Barbecue editor Daniel Vaughn digs into the history of the iconic East Austin institution, which has, during its decades in business, survived two fires, turned down a multi-million-dollar buyout offer, and recently been embroiled in a controversy involving the popular country band Midland. As Texas schools look to reopen, who will protect the teachers? Deborah D.E.P. Moten recalls how, through her years of teaching middle schoolers, she has spent her own money and endless hours caring for her students. But as the state plans to return to in-person learning in the fall, she wonders how she can protect her students and herself from COVID-19. Charlie Crockett wrote songs about difficult times, and then 2020 happened. On his latest album, Welcome to Hard Times, the Texas country musician sings of injustice and misfortune. In an interview with Julie Height, he discusses his two recent heart surgeries, his different performing personas, and why he finds today's protests encouraging. And How to create the perfect Texas staycation. Has the coronavirus pandemic upended your vacation plans? Newsletter editor Elena Betty speaks with hospitality experts across the state on how to bring the vacation vibes into your home for a relaxing day off, from a B&B worthy breakfast to sheets that will help you get better sleep. Next up, from the editor, this is also for this September issue, from Dan Goodgame, who is the editor-in-chief, and you can let him know how you feel about his material by writing him at roar, R-O-A-R, at texasmonthly.com. This month's column is entitled Knives Out. Lots of our readers love red meat. They love steaks and burgers. They love barbecued beef and pork, as well as tacos stuffed with those meats, which is why we employ a barbecue editor and a taco editor. At the same time, many of our readers say they're increasingly or exclusively eating vegetarian dishes. Executive editor Kathy Blackwell, who oversees our food coverage, helps make sure those Texans' preferences get plenty of attention in everything from our acclaimed critic Patricia Sharp's restaurant reviews to Jose R. Relat's taco stories. We're also publishing more vegetarian recipes, including one for chili from frequent contributor Paula Forbes that features a plant-based meat substitute, which we're posting on texasmonthly.com as an addition to this month's cover story. That story on the rising challenges that face ranchers and beef processors was shepherded by editor-at-large Tom Foster and written by senior editor Eric Benson. Eric moved to Austin from New York 7 years ago and quickly became, as he puts it, a total geek about grilling and smoking. He started with a Weber grill, then graduated to a Kamado Joe, but until recently, Eric says, he knew little about the supply chain for beef or the way in which this iconic Texas industry is adapting, including to criticism of its impact on global warming. I was generally aware that producing beef is very resource-intensive, Eric says, but I didn't know anything about the efforts of some ranchers to use grazing cattle to rebuild topsoil and regenerate carbon-sequestering grasslands. Accompanying Eric's story are senior editor Jason Hyde's take on the fight between Texas A&M and Harvard over the health effects of eating meat, and barbecue editor Daniel Vaughn's handy guide to specialty shops that sell some of the more rarefied varieties of Texas beef. Daniel, Kathy, and our events team are hard at work preparing for our annual BBQ Fest, which last fall celebrated its 10th anniversary and attracted 35 of the state's top pitmasters and more than 3,900 of their fans. We'd been hoping the pandemic would ease up enough to allow us to host a smaller version of the event, but we've now decided that the prudent course is to make this year's fest entirely virtual and spread it over 9 days from October 21st to November 1st. During what we're calling BBQ Fest Backyard Edition, select barbecue joints from all over Texas will, for a limited time, offer special menu items, perhaps unusual sausages, or delicacies such as pulled lamb and smoked goat for delivery or pickup, or, if restrictions allow, on-site dining. We'll have details at texasmonthly.com/TMBBQFest, where we're also selling a barbecue box stuffed with cooking tools, hats, and other goodies. For the fest finale, Daniel will host a show via a live stream from his backyard in Dallas, where he maintains 5 smokers and 3 grills, including, he admits with some embarrassment, a gas-fired model. He'll be cooking and tasting, interviewing top pitmasters for their tips, and answering readers' questions. I hope you'll join us in supporting the state's pitmasters, whose struggles Daniel has chronicled on texasmonthly.com, as well as the growing number of Texans who are out of work and short on food. Please consider a donation to Feeding Texas, the state's leading hunger relief organization, serving all 254 of our counties. I hope you'll let me know what you think of our cover package and the rest of this issue of Texas Monthly. And since we're getting into that, I'm going to read the introductory article here for the special edition about Willie Nelson. This is the introduction. It's entitled, The Willie Way. We didn't really need a reason to devote an entire magazine to the red-headed stranger. We had a few. It's by John Spong. According to my grandmother, Willie Nelson once said, the definition of music is anything that's pleasing to the ear. Once I learned that, I quit thinking about it. That's a perfect Willie quote. It touches on family and music, the two things that matter to him most. Like the songs he's written, it's clean, short, and simple on its face with a dose of his signature everyman humility. Since 1962, Willie has recorded an astounding 143 albums in just about every genre but hip-hop and heavy metal. If you've ever wondered why he has ranged so widely, the quote explains it. Apparently, Willie heard something in the various styles and songs he's explored that made him feel good, and he never worried about whether that made sense to anyone else. His grandmother told him it didn't matter. Willie gave that quote to his friend Turk Pipkin, Austin, author, comedian, and filmmaker, who also happens to be, because we are in Willie World now, a one-time professional juggler and the co-founder of a global nonprofit that has built water wells, schools, and libraries in Kenya. The two were playing golf on Willie's course outside Austin, and Pipkin was on assignment for Texas Monthly, working on a story that would run in a 2003 special issue commemorating Willie's 70th birthday. Obviously, it's not the first time Willie has landed in our pages. His first in-depth appearance in Texas Monthly came in November 1973 issue. The story, The Coming of Redneck Hip, was written by Don Roth and Jan Reed, who described one of Willie's earliest shows at the Armadillo World headquarters in Austin. At that point, there was no good reason to expect anyone to be talking about him or the magazine nearly 50 years later. Willie was a 40-year-old singer-songwriter who had written huge hits for others, most notably Crazy for Patsy Cline and Hello Walls for Farron Young, but had never managed to steer his own career anywhere near stardom. He could reliably pack dance halls and sell records in Texas, but that was about it. And the fact that he'd recently started getting some love from rock critics and grown his audience to include hippie kids in Austin didn't have to portend anything. He could very well have been setting the stage for a long career as a beloved regional act. Oh, and Texas Monthly? The issue that can contain that Redneck Hip article was just our 10th. From founding publisher Mike Levy, was still trying to convince subscribers and advertisers around Texas and the U.S. that he could pull off the statewide equivalent of a city magazine, and a lot of those people were telling him it was a bad idea. They had logic on their side. But somewhere along the line, Willie became Willie. Fans can argue about when that was. Maybe it was after he moved to Austin, and then, finally free of the Music Row industrial complex, delivered the 1-2 punch of Shotgun Willie and Phases and Stages in 1973 and 74, or maybe it was 1975's Redheaded Stranger, the bare-bones song cycle of revenge and redemption that broke him as a national act. Maybe it was the international superstardom that came in the early 80s with pop hits like Always on My Mind from 1982 and To All the Girls I've Loved Before from 1984, followed by his characteristically understated appearance in a tracksuit, jacket, jeans, and running shoes in the megastar's only video for the famine relief anthem We Are the World in 1985. Whenever it was, over the last half century, Willie grew from being Texas's favorite country singer to being one of the most beloved entertainers in the United States and then in the world. And Texas Monthly has been fortunate enough, owing partly to proximity and mostly to Willie's openness, to have a bird's-eye view of the whole long ride. Last summer, some editors at the magazine broached the unthinkable. What do we publish when Willie is gone? It's a question that media outlets around the world have asked every time he's canceled a tour date in the past 20 years, but our answer was immediate and resounding. Screw that. We need to celebrate Willie, to thank him, while he's around. So we embarked on this special issue. A few of the stories are from our archives, including profiles of Willie from when the wider world was first learning who he was, from when he was famously battling the IRS, and on the occasion of his 65th birthday, at a moment when he was feeling pensive, reflecting on what was already a well-lived life. The majority of the stories, however, are new, such as essays on his singular stature as a songwriter, vocalist, guitarist, and oddly landlord. But the most timely of the new pieces is Holly George Warren's depiction of Willie as champion of the people. George Warren describes Willie's lifetime of good acts, with a focus on his work on behalf of the American farmer. For anyone who's ever conflated FarmAid's annual All-Star concerts with the relative frivolity of Willie's 4th of July picnics, and let's face it, the man can throw a party. George Warren relates the creation story of Willie's nonprofit, detailing the rural tragedy he was addressing when he founded FarmAid in 1985. She makes the point that his work has saved not only homesteads and livelihoods, but also lives. That's a story people need right now. The world is a very different place from the one we were working in when this project started last fall. Between the COVID-19 pandemic and the long overdue reckoning with systemic racism and police brutality, no one is having an easy time. Willie has reacted the way he always does, using music to try to bring people together and get money to those who are suffering. He has played multiple live stream fundraisers from his headquarters in Luck, first to benefit musicians who could no longer play live, and later for nonprofits such as Six Square, which works to preserve Austin's historically black cultural district. As events unfolded, our special issue took on a sense of urgency. We've learned a lot from Willie over the years, and the biggest lesson became the guiding philosophy for this special issue. When life gets hard, Willie Nelson gives people a song, and Texas Monthly gives people Willie Nelson. And since we're talking about Willie, we'll get right into one of the articles that's in this special edition. It's the Canon says the best 10 albums. Over the course of his more than six decades as a recording artist, Willie Nelson released 143 legitimate albums, not counting compilations or a near infinite number of repackagings. Here, as determined by a committee of diehard fans and experts, are the greatest, with number 10 being Spirit on Island Records from 1996. Spirit, like many of Willie Nelson's greatest achievements, was a result of a combination of luck and desire. After the middle-of-the-road ballads and the personal hardships of the late 80s and early 90s, he'd been reborn in 1993's Across the Borderline. But now in his early 60s, on the cusp of old age, he was also taking stock, looking back in sadness and acceptance, and writing melancholic instrumentals like Matador in the style of the great Romani jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt, and mournful songs like Too Sick to Pray. He asked his friend Joe Gracie, sound engineer, lived down the hill from Peter Nowlett's studio, help him cut some demos. Liking what he heard in the stripped-down versions, Willie brought in some of his longtime collaborators, his sister, Bobby Nelson, on piano, guitarist Jody Payne, and fiddler Johnny Gimble. They recorded the songs in an afternoon, no drums or bass, just some of Willie's closest companions trying to match his mellow mood, playing sparely, if at all. You can hear the cracks in his voice and the creaks in his guitar. Most of Willie's best albums feature Trigger, his beat-up six-string, prominently, but none of them revolve around his guitar like Spirit. Trigger's warm, round tones introduce and close the album on bookend versions of Matador and guide all the songs in between. Mariachi is an intricate trio of guitar, fiddle, and piano played by three old friends who know one another well. Payne's ethereal harmony vocals on Your Memory Won't Die in My Grave are a rare use of sweet backups on a Willie record, and here they sound like longing made real. There's affirmation, too. I thought about you, Lord, is a modern-day hymn, and We Don't Run is an anthem as sturdy as any that come before it, as well as a pathway for the next 25 years of Willie's stubborn Zen compassion. We don't run, we don't compromise, we don't quit, we never do. We look for love, we find it in the eyes of me and the eyes of you. Just as the low-key concept album Redheaded Stranger kicked off Willie's middle decades, Spirit's song cycle of melancholy opened the door to his later ones. Willie has called Spirit his favorite record because it is so sparse. Sometimes it's in the spaces between the notes that you hear what the singer is really trying to say. By Michael Hall. Number 9 is Willie and Family Live. It's on Columbia Records in 1978. Everything you need to know about why Willie fought so hard to get out from under the thumb of the Nashville music industry and win his creative freedom is contained in this record. Recorded at Harrah's Lake Tahoe in April 1978, it spanned two vinyl discs, affording him room to summarize his career in depth. He was on top of the world, his voice at full power. Trigger was running wild, and his longtime backup band, The Family, his lineup now augmented by a second drummer and bassist, was in high-energy mode. It's a far cry from the little three-piece that he's toured with in the 60s. A new sound is evident from the start. When Willie bangs out the triumphant perch notes of a regular show opener, Whiskey River, followed by a sprint through the hallowed Bob Wills Western swing tune, Stay a Little Longer, it takes two medleys to cover the early Willie, who created Funny How Time Slips Away, Crazy, Nightlife, and Hello Walls, harkening back to an era he Riley describes in an intro as my childhood. He uses another medley from the bridge to Taste of Redheaded Stranger, but gives ferocious full-length treatments to the outlaw anthems that the casino crowd is hungry for. Good-hearted woman, I can get off on you, and mamas don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Then after the family takes a spotlight on a whirlwind under the double eagle, with everybody but the bassist and drummers getting at least one solo, he points to the future, introducing Georgia on My Mind by calling it a new recording of an old song. Was, of course, a highlight from his pop standards collection, Stardust, which was released the same month he occupied the Harris stage. The complete performance laid bare both Willie's career up to that moment and his vision of the outlaw ethos. Paranoid powers on Music Row had feared that when Willie and his compadre Waylon Jennings sought control of their own direction in the studio, they were plotting to undermine the very fabric of the country music industry. That narrow view overlooked their music's thick vein of conservatism. Willie was still playing country music, songs old and new, his heroes and his own, when he was finally doing it his way on his terms, as written by Rich Hainsel. Number 8 is his Across the Borderline album he did on Columbia Records in 93. The early 90s were a near impossible time for Willie. His troubles with the Internal Revenue Service dragged on. His uneven late 80s output had caught up to him. His singles were now lucky to crack the country top 50. At the end of 91, his son Billy died, and the following spring, in a bid to satisfy the feds, Willie left the road for a soul-crushing residency at a supper club in Branson, Missouri. 1992 would wind up being the only year of his career in which he didn't release a new album or even a single. But in February 1993, he finally settled up with the IRS, and 7 weeks later, he released Across the Borderline. It wasn't a return to form, but a rebirth. Guided by Don Was, the rock producer whose comeback records for Bonnie Raitt and the B-52s had turned both acts into multi-platinum sellers, Willie took chances. Borderline opens with just him and Trigger on Paul Simon's American Tune, and when he sings of feeling weary to my bones, he doesn't sound like he's interpreting someone else's words. But at the bridge, his voice is joined by pedal steel. I dreamed my soul rose unexpectedly, looking back down at me, smiled reassuredly, and there it is, salvation in song. From there, the album is one surprise after another, and every one works. On Getting Over You, Willie's nasal whine melts into Raitt's easy rasp for one of his finest duets. He and Sinead O'Connor nail Peter Gabriel's Don't Give Up. He does another Simon cover as well as two each by John Hiatt and Lyle Lovett, one by Bob Dylan, and he duets with Dylan on a new song they co-wrote. Plus, he brings in two new songs of his own, Valentine, a lullaby for his son Lucas, and the album closing, Still Is Still Moving to Me, a 90-mile-an-hour testament to perseverance that races like a runaway train. Sales were modest, and Columbia soon dropped him, but that proved to be a gift. The label, which had allowed him to blaze new trails in two directions two decades earlier, now wanted him to coast on nostalgia, but Across the Borderline brought him a fresher, younger audience, launching a third act that only Willie knew he had in him. That was written by John Spong. Number 7, and we're getting close to the end of the reading, so I'm going to stop with that one, and we'll get the rest of them next time. Number 7 is Who'll Buy My Memories? It's the IRS tapes. It was a Sony special music product from 1991. For all the strange creation myths behind so many Willie albums and all the hit-and-miss records that resulted, the story behind this one is the Williest. When the IRS raided his ranch in November 1990, hitting him with a $32 million bill for delinquent taxes, he wasn't exactly ambushed. He'd been negotiating with the agency ever since it had disallowed some old tax shelters and upped his amount owed, and he'd actually talked the figure down to $16.7 million. Problem was, he didn't have the money. But unwilling to declare bankruptcy and stiff the feds, he worked to make good on his debt. He performed a new song in a Taco Bell commercial. He signed Jose Cuervo to sponsor a tour. He booked Branson. And then he released this record. The IRS tapes includes 25 Willie originals that he had recorded in December 1984 with just his vocals and Trigger. They weren't demos. All the songs had been around since at least the early 70s, so they sound well-worn. His voice sure, where the perfect notes hide. His picking simple, but exquisite. He avoided obvious choices. There's no crazy or hello walls. Instead, he went with less cited tracks from minor albums such as Permanently Lonely and Buddy from 1968's Good Times and Will You Remember and Country Willie from 1972's The Words Don't Fit the Picture. The best known songs were four from 1974's Phases and Stages, including Pretend I Never Happened and How Will I Know I'm Falling in Love Again. Emotionally fraught in their original context, they're almost painfully intimate here. This is what Willie would sound like if he were singing Only to You. The tapes had been among Willie's possessions that had been seized by the IRS, but he persuaded the agency to let him release them and create this 2-CD collection, promising the IRS $5 for each set sold. He enlisted famed producer Bob Johnston to clean them up, and he sold them on late-night TV via a 1-800 number with his picture on the cover in a Happens t-shirt. Those sales didn't get near to clearing his debt, and made a dent, and 2 years later, he reached a settlement with the government, and fans got the IRS tapes, the purest expression of his artistry on record. And with that, it brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to...
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30. Monday, Recording Library of West Texas Radio invites you to join us for Labor Day as we celebrate the American worker with a day of music, fun, and drama. Starting Monday afternoon at 1, we invite you to go cruising with us as we present the Back to School Labor Day Special, hosted by Mike Harvey. Catch over 3 hours of fun oldies from the 60s and 70s. Then, at approximately 4:15, it's the sitcom mockumentary on a group of typical office workers, where the workday consists of ego clashes, inappropriate behavior, and tedium. The Office, audio described, starring John Krasinski and Jenna Fischer. And Monday night at 7, the audio described 1992 movie, Newsies, a musical based on the New York City newsboy strike of 1899. When young newspaper sellers are exploited beyond reason by their bosses, they set out to enact change and are met by the ruthlessness of big business. Celebrate Labor Day with us. It all starts Monday afternoon at 1 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 90 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McClamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and the Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the August issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with Touchdown in College Towns. Football fandom collides with small-town charm in these four destinations, by Jason Boyett and Thomas Jones. Even though the state is still deadlocked in oppressive summer heat, something in the air changes in August. College football fans know exactly what we mean. Around this time of year, they're perfecting their tailgate menus and purchasing new gear to sport their school's colors. While cities like Austin, College Station, Lubbock, and Waco boast high-profile programs, nothing beats the enthusiasm and warmth of small towns, with under-the-radar football teams like those in Canyon, Denton, San Marcos, and Huntsville. While the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic may keep you from seeing your favorite teams live this year, we hope this guide will serve as an inspiration for future trips. West Texas A&M University in Canyon. Last season was an auspicious one for West Texas A&M University. Home games finally returned to campus, and the Buffaloes ended the season with an impressive 8-3 record, a turnaround from the team's 9-13 record during head coach Hunter Hughes' first two seasons. The opening of the new Buffalo Stadium in 2019 marked the first time since 1959 the West Texas A&M Buffaloes actually played home games on the university's grounds. Previously, home games were held at Kimbrough Stadium, recently renamed to Happy State Bank Stadium, north of Canyon. The new field brought a fresh wind of excitement back to Canyon and its Division II team. The new stadium introduced new traditions. For every home game, WTAMU now closes down 26th Street, which bisects the campus and runs directly toward the stadium, to host the university-sanctioned Buffalo Block Party. More than 60 businesses and vendors occupy the block, which opens to the public 4 hours before kickoff. Area banks cook hot dogs on enormous smokers, student organizations hand out noisemakers and T-shirts, and local bands provide live music beneath towering elm trees. The festive atmosphere increases exponentially for a homecoming weekend, scheduled for October 16th. The Canyon Chamber of Commerce hosts a citywide barbecue called the Canyon Chamber Chowdown. This year it will be held in the downtown square. A single admission price includes ribs and brisket. The evening pep rally features student-led chants and music. During games, the university's mascot, a bison named Thunder the Fourth, hangs out on the field in a designated area. In the past, trained students would run the animal across the field after each touchdown, but that custom has ceased due to safety concerns. The live mascot tradition dates to bison purchased in 1922 from Colonel Charles Goodnight's historic herd. Another monument to the school's mascot is the White Buffalo Sculpture, located in the middle of Citizens Bank Plaza, near the southern entrance to Buffalo Stadium. The late Jack Hill, a local sculptor, designed and originally installed the 9-foot-tall, 1,800-pound landmark in 1967 at the old off-campus stadium. With much more to explore around Canyon, visitors may want to cross campus to the Panhandle Plains Historical Museum on 4th Avenue. It's the largest history museum in the state due to its more than 2 million artifacts, and has been a jewel of the university since the 1920s. Guests can easily spend a Saturday afternoon exploring its collections, from the fossilized bones of saber-toothed cats to firearms that belong to Texas legends like Goodnight and Comanche Chief Quanah Parker. Of course, no trip to Canyon is complete without visiting its namesake, Palo Duro Canyon State Park. Located 12 miles east of Canyon on State Highway 217, this nearly 28,000-acre geological wonder is known for its spectacular views and hike and bike and horse trails. Less rustic diversions may prove more tempting for some. Bar Z Winery is located just 10 minutes northeast of the campus. Owned by Monty Dixon and Amber Dobler Dixon, this winery partners with vineyards in the High Plains to produce award-winning vintages, like its 2016 Pinot Noir, which earned a gold medal in the 2018 San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition. The Bar Z Tasting Room offers a relaxing place to unwind and take in a gorgeous autumn sunset. Where to stay? End your day at Hudspeth House, a bed and breakfast located between the campus and Courthouse Square. This property dates to 1909, making it around the same age as WTAMU and almost as old as the town itself. A former boarding house, it served the earliest students and faculty of the original West Texas State Normal College, including famed artist Georgia O'Keeffe, who took most of her meals there during her tenure in Canyon. Staff maintained cleanliness during the COVID-19 pandemic by wearing gloves and wiping down furniture and counters after guests check out. Rates start at $130 per night. University of North Texas in Denton. When visiting Denton for a University of North Texas football game, pack plenty of green. The color of the university's official team moniker, Mean Green, proliferates across this college town. The color also represents UNT's reputation as an environmental beacon on the rolling prairie about a Hail Mary from the outer fringe of the Dallas-Fort Worth suburbs. UNT's 30,000-seat Apogee Stadium is the first college football stadium in the country awarded a Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED, Platinum Certification, which measures a building's sustainable design. The stadium grounds also include three wind turbines, a visual testament to UNT's environmental consciousness. According to school officials, UNT is the first university in Texas to have wind turbines placed on campus property and one of the first universities in the U.S. to integrate renewable technology into an athletic complex and football stadium. Fans gather on the hills and greens surrounding the stadium to tailgate and rally for the Division I program, which is in its 104th year and has had its string of three consecutive bowl games snapped with last season's 4-8 campaign. About 30 minutes before each home game, the Green Brigade, UNT's marching band, struts its stuff through the tailgating area. The good vibes extend into the stadium, according to 2020 graduate Sarah Shirley, who performed as the school's mascot, Scrappy the Eagle, since her freshman year. "The student section is so respectful of other schools," says Shirley, a Denton native who earned her degree in rehabilitation studies. "Everyone is there to relax and have a good time. I've been at other schools that weren't like that at all. I've seen and heard things that wouldn't fly at UNT." As for casting aside the Scrappy costume, Shirley says she'll miss mingling with young fans the most. "I'll really miss meeting kids," she says. "They love Scrappy. Everyone wants to take pictures and get hugs. For some of them, meeting Scrappy is like meeting a superhero." When you've had your fill of pomp and tradition, retreat to the courthouse square to take in the town's other attractions. LSA Burger Company offers juicy patties alongside an impressive selection of locally crafted beer, and colorful murals by area artists dot the square. The courthouse on the square museum gives a solid primer on the town's frontier history. A quick drive to the surrounding countryside reveals one of the primary industries currently operating in the North Texas prairie, horse farms. With prearranged tours, guests can get a glimpse into the processes of breeding, developing, and training the country's top racehorses. While Denton may not tout itself as a live music capital, no town in Texas punches higher above its weight class when it comes to musical talent. UNT's College of Music produces an array of artists that play everything from jazz to punk and experimental riffs that can't be classified. Dan's Silverleaf is a reliable music venue and dive bar, while Andy's Bar hosts an eclectic mix of live music in one of the oldest buildings on the square. After a mean green win, there is a different kind of music that floats through the air. As throngs march in celebration to McConnell Tower, which tops the Hurley Administration Building in the heart of campus, they sing the school song, "Glory to the Green," and watch the tower light up. Yep, you guessed it, green. Where to stay? Just east of town, the old Irish Bed and Breakfast offers a home base complete with a replica Irish pub and a pack of curious alpacas. At this time, breakfast is served in guest rooms. Everything is sanitized, including hot tubs and furniture. Rates start at $99 per night. Texas State University in San Marcos. Even though Austin and its surrounding communities comprise the fastest-growing metropolitan area in the nation, nearby San Marcos remains, unapologetically, a college town. Students lounge along the San Marcos River, sip coffee at the coffee bar or cafe on the square, and tap their feet to tunes at Showdown and Cheatham Street Warehouse. The frenetic energy of Austin seems more like 30 years away than 30 miles. But don't think this relaxed nature pertains to Saturday afternoons in autumn. Texas State has earned its reputation as a school that likes to have a good time, and a football game offers a rowdy tailgating scene, complete with lots of eating, drinking, and dancing. The university's football program started in 1904. Today's Division I team has had just one winning season since joining the Sun Belt Conference in 2013. Even if a bowl game trophy might not be in sight, the band, cheerleaders, and spirit groups add to the pageantry of any home game, and few schools can match the history of Texas State's Strutters. The dance team, the first and largest such squad of any